Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Homage to the Buddha, the Blessed Noble and Fully Self-Awakened One. I would like to start with that just to remind myself that I am actually trying to teach the teaching of the Buddha and not my own, just in case I get confused. This is a talk that I always give. It's really aimed at people who are fairly new or who need to be reminded of what the practice is about. The first thing to be clear about is what the Buddha means by right awareness. And then we have to know how to deal with stuff that comes up so that we can maintain that right awareness. All the what's known as the hindrances, when the mind wanders and all that. And then finally, we need to be clear about what it is we're actually trying to investigate. There's no point in sitting there thinking we're investigating the right thing and recognizing that we're not. To get this idea of right awareness, I would like to just run through the Buddha's own experience so that we know where he's coming from. So remember that he left home for seemingly two reasons. First of all, the ordinary delights of daily life, the sex, drugs and rock and roll had sort of lost their flavour. So he was a bit fed up with all that. But worse was he was going through what we would call sort of an existential crisis. This comes through the myth where he's out on his chariot and he comes across a very sick person, a very old person, a corpse, and somebody, an ascetic, sitting under a tree. And at each time, he sort of recognizes that this is what he's heading for. He's in his mid-20s, and as you know, once you reach your mid-20s, there's not much ahead of you. So he's looking at sickness, aging, and death, and he's thinking to himself, well, what's all this about? Now, the obsession in those days was rebirth, the idea that reincarnation, that you come back again and again and again, depending on what you did, depending on the circumstance, you know, you'd be reborn as a Raja or as a laborer or as a rat. So it was all a bit a terrible thing to think. But there were people in those days who used to meditate and say that they could get into the ecstatic states which when you die you could remain in. So there's all sorts of theories, and there were materialists too, you know, people who said that when you're dead, you're dead. So with this sort of confused mind, he left home, which sounds to us pretty sort of callous, really. His child had just been born. He called his child Rahula, which means chain, a weight. Later on, for those of you who don't know, he did join the order and become fully liberated, so there was a bit of payback there. He then left, and he did the thing. He dropped all his robes and all his fine robes and joined these ascetics in the forest, in the jungle. And the first two that he went to taught him how to achieve these very high mental states, which you get in all religions, through the practice of prayer, repetitive prayer, mantra, visualizations, that sort of stuff, yeah? And the great thing about those things are that when you are in that state, of course, you're completely blissed out. And once you think, well, that's what life's about, you can see how easy it is just to, you know, have a couple of rag clothes, a bowl, go out and beg some food and go and sit under a tree, blissed out for the rest of the day. The problem was that every time he came out of these states, he was back to being his old depressed, anxious Siddhartha Gautama. So he didn't think that really answered his question. He was an adept, because in both cases they asked him to be a teacher. So then he tried a different methodology, which was self-mortification. Now this was on a different sort of tack. This was the idea that the soul, the eternal soul, was trapped in the body because of its bad behavior. And it had to be released from the body, and once it would do that, it would enter into eternal heaven. So the body was at fault. One had to reduce the body. And the great teacher of that at the time was the Nigantha, the leader of the Jains. And in the Jain religion, those who starve themselves to death for religious purposes are considered saints. And many old people, when they face death, they'll actually just stop eating. It's an accepted way of receiving death. And the Buddha tried this, and he got so thin he said he could hold his spine through his stomach. So now if you try that, you can see how thin he was. Wow. So he really reduced himself to this sort of wafer-thin person. And but again, after about 4 years of this, you know, if we go along with the general story, he just realized that it was just more suffering. And the suffering was caused by, you know, causing the body to be in always in a state of discomfort on the understanding that this soul would finally release itself. So he lost confidence in that. And then he leaves his companions, who thought he'd gone soft. And he's sitting by the roadside, looking pretty depressed, I thought, because he's tried everything, and he's still, like, there's no answer. You know, he's been round everywhere, and he's still stuck with this problem of suffering. And this idea of constantly being reborn. So at that time, we know her name. This woman passes by with an offering for a local god, Sujata, which means auspicious birth. And seeing this poor wretch offers him the food. Of course, in the scriptures, she sees a god, but it's ridiculous. Huh? He's in a state of, he's emaciated, and he's looking pretty miserable. But the thing is that he eats this, and it revives him. It's a little sweetmeat, rice sweetmeat. And at this point, he has a memory, and it's because of this memory, this kernel memory, that we call him self-awakened, because up until then, nobody seems to have found this. So this memory is of himself as a child watching his father doing a plowing ceremony. And what he remembers is being in the same state of absorption, but there was something added to it, which was this sense of curiosity. Like, what's my daddy doing? And this turned his whole practice around. Instead of trying to achieve happiness, he turned inward to find out how he was creating suffering. And it was with this sort of inspiration that he sat under what's now known as the Bodhi tree, the religious fig tree. It's called religious fig because he became enlightened under it. Before that, it was just a fig tree. So he sat under this tree and he determined that he would either be, you know, he'd either crack this or he'd die. You know, really strong determination. So I always say, lucky for him, lucky for us, he actually cracked the problem. And he spends that whole next night just thinking about what he's actually, you know, got there. So what he discovers is that there is an experience. There's an experience which is beyond, it is transcendent of the psychophysical world, of the world of phenomena. That's what he discovers, right? And he calls it, became to be called Nirvana. Now, if we go back on that and just think of that moment when he's a child, and we'll understand what he means by right awareness. When you see a child and it's become very interested in something, I always think of this image because I was watching this little girl. She was about 3 or 4 or something, or a bit older maybe. And she'd seen a little creature, I think it was a beetle or something, or an earwig. And she locked onto it. You know, like, you couldn't disturb her. The eyes were just locked onto this creature, this little creature. And the jaw dropped. So that, from an adult point of view, she looked gormless. So you have to give her a clip on the head and say, wake up, you know. Anyway, the thing is that the fixation of the eyes just shows you that there's this absolute absorption in that sense of curiosity, or like, what is this? And the jaw dropping tells us there's no thinking, right? Because the jaw, the mouth are all related to thought patterns. So there she is, this little girl. She's just completely absorbed in watching this, and she must have been there for, I don't know, a quarter, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes, maybe half a minute. And then, of course, she comes out of that and asks what it is. And mother says it's a beetle, and that's it. So what happens now is that the child has a photocopy in the mind of a beetle. Okay, so the next beetle that the child sees, she just says, oh, that's a beetle, right? And that's it. She thinks that she knows the beetle because now she's plonked this name on it. And that's what we're doing all the time. We're looking at the world through conceptual thinking. Right? We're never actually going back to that sense base, to that direct experience of something, unless, of course, we really want to. So, for instance, if you go for a meal and you've ordered something like a curry and you want to know what's in the curry, you'll actually put your attention right on the tongue to actually taste the different herbs. Otherwise, you'll just be chewing away and swallowing while having a great conversation, right? And you'll say, oh yeah, that was a nice curry. But I mean, like it just slipped through the mouth and down the throat. So, if you can have that image of a child, yeah? Fixed eyes, the concentration, the jaw drop, no thinking, and just that overpowering sense of curiosity. That's right awareness. Okay? The word awareness always occurs with another one. It's always with panya. It's always satima, atapi, sampajano satima. That's the direct quotation. With real good effort, with curiosity, with intuitive intelligence and awareness, being aware. Right? So you can translate that as just a direct intuitive awareness that you're developing. Okay? And if you've got that image in the mind, then at least you've got a sort of, some way of entering into it. Okay? Now, the hindrances, the thing that takes us away, finding ourselves dreaming and all that sort of stuff, they split into two types. There's all those that make us excited and create dreams, our desires, our aspirations and all that, all the little hatreds and anxieties, yeah? All the guilts, remorse, shames. Oh, there's a whole gamut of human misery there, yeah? And what this does, when the heart moves, it starts creating these stories for us. And when we're in the story, of course, unwittingly, we're actually developing that mental state. That's one of the things that you've got to recognize. Whenever your mind wanders on its own, it's developing the mental state that's actually empowering it. So if you want to get worried, just keep worrying. If you want to worry more, just keep worrying more. I mean, it feels as though it's a release. It's like anger, you know, like you feel, you know, if you got really angry and banged a door and threw a bottle or something, that's it, you've got rid of your anger. But actually, you've churned it up, you've developed a bit more, so next time you throw a brick. Like, it feels like a release, but it's not, it's a development, right? And that's what you begin to recognize. And then you begin to be quite wary about letting your mind just wander off somewhere, you know. And the technique there is always the same. It doesn't matter. As soon as you find yourself in some sort of fantasy, you really recognize, acknowledge what's pushing it. Right? So is it irritation? Is it excitement? Planning something? And you come back in the body and you feel it. Right? You feel it here, right? And you just stay with it until it exhausts itself. And that way, it's sort of the heart's healing itself. Now, you might come in the body, you might not feel anything at all, in which case, just go back to the breath. Or you might come into the body, you might not feel anything but tightness, say, around the abdomen. So if that draws your attention, go there. But don't guess, oh, this is anxiety. You might be intuitively right, but that's not what you're experiencing. What you're actually experiencing is tightness in the abdomen. See what I mean? And it's driving your attention to your direct sensual experience. Right? Don't get caught up in what the mind thinks. Right? It's opinions. Okay? And that's what you keep doing. And don't be, for those of you who are fairly new, don't be surprised that if you open up to anxiety, it actually gets much worse. Okay? Like, it's because the heart actually feels free now to express its turbulence to you. And remember, the heart speaks in feelings. It doesn't speak in words. Okay? So if you think, oh, well, I'm not really an angry person. No, I don't really get very angry. And then you sit there and you go, boom! And oh, my God, this meditation is terrible. It's making me angry. No, you've just opened up to the amount of anger you've not cared to look at all these years. You see what I mean? So with that sort of, any time the mind wanders, that's all you're doing. You're just waking up to it. As soon as you wake up, you've got to be clear as to what is empowering the mind. And then you come into the body, you feel it, you let it express itself. Okay? Sometimes it carries on a while. Eh? It just doesn't go because, you know, the heart doesn't say, oh, now that you've opened up to me, I'll go away. You know, like, it can stay there for donkey's years, frankly. I don't want to get you depressed. So the other one is, of course, the other side of that is dullness and lethargy. So these, remember that there is, there's obviously tiredness, you know, there's a natural tiredness and a need for sleep, but it's the other stuff where we've taken happiness, where we found happiness in oblivion. That might seem strange, but in oblivion there's no suffering, is there? It's fantastic. So if things get a bit on top of you, what do? You launch yourself onto the couch and disappear for a while. See? And it's being able to just disappear for a while. And it feels good. Sometimes you wake up worse, but at least when you're down there, it feels all right. Unfortunately, of course, that's a suppressive measure. Right? It's just another aversion. So you're pushing the stuff away with layers and layers of lethargy and dullness and sloth. And when we're sitting here, that's what comes up, you see. So it's a valid. Sometimes we think, oh, we're just tired. But it's a real mental state that we have to work with. This feeling of a dullness in the mind, like porridge, and heaviness in the body. And sometimes, of course, it's difficult to distinguish that from real tiredness, which is caused by maybe overload at work, who knows, worries in life, you know. So when you're doing a day retreat like this, or a weekend, or even a week, sometimes you've just got to recognize that maybe there is real tiredness, and it isn't dullness and lethargy. But then, normally if you're on a week retreat, if you do one, after 4 days, you can't kid yourself anymore. Okay? It is dullness and lethargy. Right? you've got to stand up, you've got to move around, you've got to absolutely refuse to be annihilated. That's the thing, you see. And you stay with the feelings, because it's a feeling, it's an energy. So if we think of these things that make the mind wander as a sort of whirlwind, this is a whirlpool. It's sort of, you know, it's a real energy just driving us down into that sort of state of oblivion. And it's energy. It takes energy out of our system. It might feel good to go into it, but it actually means that you've got less energy for doing things in life. And that's how you can get into awful states of close to sort of depression states, where you just don't have the energy to do anything. It's because the energy is inside us just drawing us down all the time. That's to be distinguished from depression. Right? So those are the two major things that you're working with to maintain mindfulness. Now, these things become our teachers, right? They're not to be seen as hindrances in the sense of they're stopping me from becoming liberated. No, it's working with those. That is the process of liberation. Because the insights that we have are to do with seeing things as they are, but concurrent with that, there has to be a purification of the heart, right? The heart has to purify itself. So, you know, it'd be funny, wouldn't it, if the Buddha said he was fully liberated and then you caught him shoplifting. I mean, it's a mismatch, isn't it? So the heart's got to be purified, and that's really what the difficulty is. The insights come and go. The insights come just because that's the way the intelligence works. You see things. But the heart is where the work is. And so finally, what is it that we're looking at? Well, we're looking at how we create suffering. And I pointed out to you in the meditation, this mechanism of desire. Right? When something comes up, we always have a relationship to it. We either want it or we don't want it. Now, we live in a world of duality, in the sense that whether we like it or not, whatever we experience is either shading towards what's pleasant or shading towards the unpleasant. Right? Even the neutral bit, if you actually go into it closely, you'll see it shades one way or the other. That's the way we experience life. Sometimes it's pleasant, sometimes it's unpleasant. But how do you relate to that, you see? That's where the Buddha points to the problem. Right? And this desiring, this wrong desire, always to hold on to what's pleasant, to try and develop it. See? And then when it's something's negative, to either push it away, and if it's too much, you run for it. The fight, flight. So these three basic positions that we've taken of acquisitiveness and aversion and fear are at the base of our relationship to the world in the negative sense. Remember, there's always a positive stuff. There's a love and compassion and joy. But in terms of our negative approach to life and what's causing us problems, it's always from these three basic positions. We're either trying to hold on to something, keep it, making it growing, yeah? Or we're trying to push something away or run away from it. Acquisitiveness, aversion, and fear. And what you're doing in your meditation is you're trying to be aware of these reactions that we have. And just, that's all you have to do, remember. You don't have to do anything. You're not trying to change anything. Right? The system itself begins to evaporate as you just watch it. Right? The system itself collapses as you watch it. So here you have, say, pain in the knee, and it's got to a point where you really want to move, but you know that it's not that bad, like the knee's not exploding yet. So you're saying pain, and you can feel wanting to move. It's a resistance, yeah? And if you just hang on that for a while, this resistance disappears, and you find yourself equanimous with pain. But you still know it's pain. See? And then you might go into the pain, and as you go into the pain, you find that your noting word changes, or at least your perception changes. It's tightness or heat. And when you're down there, you see, there's no idea of pain. So when you come to the second level of perception, which is meaning, and you say, oh, well, that's pain, then you realize it's a mental construct. Pain doesn't actually exist. What exists are these sensations. And when you're down at the sensation base, there's no rejection of it. There's no fear of it or anything. It's only when you recognize it as pain that the reaction comes. And the reaction is to be separated from the pain. And we've got to decide is, where's the suffering? Is pain suffering? Or is my attitude to it suffering? Right? Now that's the same with emotions. So if I wake up with feeling depressed, so okay, I say depressed, and my immediate reaction is, well, that's very depressing. So I'm depressed about being depressed. But if I go back to the depression and just sink into it, what do I feel? I usually just feel heavy, that's all. Heavy and a bit muzzy and all that sort of stuff, and then it sort of disappears after the time. It doesn't have to disappear so quickly, but sometimes it does. So then you realise that depression is also a mental concept. Which doesn't mean to say that you don't go and get something done about it if it becomes a problem, but it's a mental concept. And as soon as you say, I'm depressed today, right, then you get the reaction to it, right? You're upset with it, you're angry with it, you're afraid of it. See? Just as a little side comment, these days we use this word depression, and it turns it into a mental illness. But, you know, I was brought up at a time where you just used to say, oh, it's a bit of a downer. That was it. It wasn't a mental illness. You just felt a bit down. So that's just a little thing. So what we're observing is this process of some sort of sensation, physical or mental, the way we label it and how we react to it. And to really observe, to really try to distinguish where the suffering is. Right? The suffering is in the reaction. That's why the Buddha says desire is the cause of suffering. Second noble truth. Okay? That's what he's talking about. He's not talking about those desires which are wholesome. You know, desires that come out of love, compassion, sympathetic joy. It's just difficult to translate the word. Tanha in the Pali means that desire which is coming out of delusion. Okay? It's often translated as craving, which is sort of over the top, really. It's just any desire which is arising out of acquisitiveness, aversion, or fear. Yeah. The second one is impermanence. So, if you said to somebody in the street, "Well, everything changes," they say, "Yeah." I mean, you know, that's no big insight, is it? Everything changes. But the Buddha pointed out that the one who's observing is also changing. So it's the sense of self which is also arising and passing away. Where does your sense of self go when you're asleep? It's gone, hasn't it? And then you wake up and you say, ah, me again. Or, oh, not you again. One or the other. One or the other. See, then suddenly the self arises. Now, according to Buddhist psychology, the self is constantly dying and reaffirming it and arising with that point of identity. See? And it's catching that which is the real insight into our psychology. Now, that sense of self, when you find yourself clearly in yourself as the observer, I'm getting confused, that the impermanence, right? What you're catching is the ending of things, right? And what we've got to, our society always makes us look at something new. See, just before something ends, something new comes to take our distraction away. See? So what happened to the last pop star? I never know, because there's another one come in to get involved with. You know, it's like, what happened to that footballer? He disappeared, that's it. It's the next one who comes in that I become aware of. So you're always looking for, you're always, just as you come to the end of something, the mind slips onto something else that's new. Right? So just as you come to the end of one ice cream, you're thinking, where's the next one? You don't actually finish the ice cream, right? And the reason is that we don't catch that moment that this is finished, it's complete, it's dead like the parrot, right? It's gone. It's because each one of those moments is a little death, right? We don't like to look at death. So every time you come to the end of something, like you've had your cup of tea and just sit in front of it, just know, that's it, it's gone, it's finished. I'll never have that cup of tea again. I'll have another one, but not that one. And every day, you see, before you go to sleep, say to yourself, that's it. What happened? Where's it gone? And it's acknowledging the ending of things, which is really taking us to understanding what impermanence means to us as individuals. And we don't really know what that means until the doctor says you've got a couple of weeks to live. Right? Then you know what impermanence actually means. So our meditation is preparing us for that inevitable end. And when you do that, of course, you'll get your reactions to it. You know, it can be quite fearful. And the final one is this teaching about not self. So the Buddha never said there was no self. He just said it wasn't real. That's different, right? He didn't say there's no self. It's not real. So what he's asking us to do is to acknowledge that everything we experience is an object. So I said in that meditation, the perceiver cannot be the perceived. Now, is that true? The perceiver cannot be the perceived. So if I'm looking at that bell, it cannot be me. If I'm looking at you, you cannot be me. Right? I've separated you away from this sense of who I am. There was a woman called Margaret Mahler. She was an associate of Freud who studied children to the age of 3. And all these studies have been replicated. And it seems that about to the age of 4, some of you will know this, about the age of 4, we live in a sort of two-dimensional sensation. It's just coming at us, all these, you know, sometimes we're tasting something and we feel, and we're crying and then we're laughing. And then after 4 months, something looms out of this two-dimensional space. And that's why they say the babies reach out for, when they're reaching out for rattles, they're actually creating that 3D. And the first object is your carer, your mother usually, yeah? And then over a period of time, the world's pushed away. And it takes 3 years for that little child to finally say, I'm a boy, I'm a girl, and everything else is not me. It's a 3-year process. All we're doing is going inward and pushing everything out from ourselves, right? Thoughts are up there, images are up there, emotions are down here somewhere, the body is over there, right? What is it that is pushing, that is pulling itself out of this psychophysical organism and finding this position of the observer, this observation post? What is that? Okay? So every time you pull yourself away out of what's inside you, you're removing your identity. So body identity, an obvious case, the one I normally pick on, is, you know, you trap your finger in a door. See, for that one wonderful singular moment, you are the pain. Yeah? Just that one, and then, of course, you get angry and kick the door. But this pain, at that point, you are the pain. That's what we mean by identity. There's no separation between you and the experience. When you walk into a cinema or at home watching a DVD, you sit down. You're sort of generally aware of yourself. You've got your cup of tea and all that. And then you lose yourself, don't you? 2 hours, you wake up and say, oh, that's a good film. Where have you been? You've been completely absorbed in that film. You become your own... remember that all you're getting from the screen are just little photons. Everything else is being manufactured in this psychophysical organism. Yeah? And you've been in there. You've become that simulation. And then you've woken up and said, oh, that's a good film. That's identity, right? So when you pull yourself out of that, who are you when you become the observer? Okay? So I always say to people, when that becomes very clear to you, especially when your meditation is very calm, very peaceful, and you've pulled back into yourself as the observer, the feeler, turn your attention towards the observer. What is it? What's it made of? What's inside it? Okay? Because the Buddha's pointing to something within us which doesn't die, isn't born, wasn't created, is not conditioned, and is perfectly awake. Right? There is a consciousness which is not touched by any of the psychophysical organism. It has no boundary, because there's no phenomena, and in all directions full of light. Just this is the end of suffering. So it's not as though the enlightenment or the awakening is in the future somewhere. It's not as though we're manufacturing it. It's right here. It's right here in our looking. You're looking at me with it. Fancy. And so when you're in that very clear state of the observer, and you've turned everything else clearly into an object, and that's one of the benefits of this particular technique that I teach, the noting, where you can say, there's pain and there's my foot. See? So you're always separating this awareness from what it's aware of. See? Draw your attention to that feeling of the observer. What is it? Okay. So, when it comes to understanding what the Buddha means by right awareness, there's always these two components. Intuitive awareness, right? There's a awareness is passive, it's the reception. When we're doing the standing meditation, that was governed by awareness, just that passivity of just being. Okay? It's within that passivity that the active side exists too, which is the grasping of the object, the intuition. You can't separate them. One is simply looking, and the next moment you're seeing. Okay? So it's the same thing, it's just one's passive and one's active. So first you have to look and then you see. And that's all you're doing. You're just looking and it will see. Right? If you try and see, you're getting in the way. Right? Because you're coming at it from some sort of concept. Now if you say to yourself, well, I know what Nibbana is, and you sit there in awareness, you're looking for it. See? And you think it's out there somewhere. And then there are these hindrances that take us away, but then become something that our trainers, they become something that we're actually learning from. So there's all those fantasies around that take us away on these dreams, and there's this dullness and lethargy. On both accounts, we always turn into the body to feel, to experience fully what's actually happening there. Okay? Just let it evaporate. And then finally, sometimes you're aware of desire, not wanting. I mean, it's pretty strong sometimes. Sometimes you're aware of something arising, passing away, the breath, you see. And sometimes you're aware that what you're looking at is an object. It's not me. You can sometimes sit with, beginning with the intention, right, well, this sitting, I'm going to really try and see this impermanence. I'm going to try and catch the ending of everything. So you can set yourself a task, but then during the sitting, just let go of that, right? Just let this intelligence do its own thing. Okay.